M1 is the finance super app where you can invest, borrow, save, and spend all in one place. You set your strategy, and they automate it for free in an easy-to-use app. M1 is making money management easier, smarter, and more automated than ever. If you're like me and you struggle to make time for investing, or anything really, M1 is the best set-it-and-forget-it investing app I've ever used. Go to m1finance.com/Katoon to get started today and earn $30 to invest after you fund your account. Terms and conditions apply. M1, yours to build. First off, Hadley, welcome to Technori Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here. I'm a fan and follower on Twitter, which is where I seem to find all of my guests now. It used to be an endless list of PR people sending me people. And that, like, not that that's bad. I'm still down with it. But Twitter is better because I literally can find a person, learn a ton about what they do, what they're into, and then have them on the show. And instead of doing the old, like, so tell me about your job title, we literally can, like, get to know each other. So thank you for taking the time and joining the show.
Thanks for having me, Scott. Appreciate it.
My next question is, when are you going to follow me on Twitter? No, I'm just kidding. That's not my next question.
I will right after.
Yes, I've got it.
I'm really bad at multitasking.
I am as well. I'm supposed to have all these pictures on the wall. There's, like, you don't see it probably, but there's like 8 pictures in a row here. And my co-founder comes by every day and is like, day one of the new office, you brought these pictures in. We are now like day 90. They're still sitting on the floor. So multitasking, not my thing either. We're going to get into a bunch of different stuff here, but I want to learn kind of who you are. This is not that, like, deep, what did your dad do and did they approve of your work question. Just like, who are you? And what do you do? How have you gotten here? I know we're going to talk about the VC piece here in a minute, but I know that you founded a handful of companies before this. And I feel like context-wise, there's a gazillion podcasts if you're here to learn about how to become a VC. I feel like it's almost better at this stage to look at people who've already done it and kind of look back on their life history and be like, oh, that's how you become a VC. It's not like something I set out to do as much as it is something that happened to me.
Yeah, no, that's true for me as well. I don't think I even knew what a VC did or had any kind of context until I was almost 30. So definitely an example of that. Yeah, just kind of quick background. I grew up in Boston, really liked math and science, or should say those are the only things I was good at. So studied engineering at Penn, where I actually met my 3 co-founders of ENIAC. We're all engineering students, graduated way back in 99. Worked as a developer for a while, went back to grad school for a business degree, did some big company time at Microsoft and Samsung, and just really didn't like it. I kind of figured out, big companies weren't for me, just didn't seem to be having any kind of impact. And then wasn't sure what I wanted to do next. I was living in actually Korea, working for Samsung in corporate strategy, moved back to Boston to just kind of figure it out. I either wanted to start a company or get into what I learned. VC had like worked with startups, so I kind of wanted to do something to startup ecosystem. Had this thesis around mobile being the next kind of evolution of computing that I'd picked up when I was in Korea, because they already had 4G networks there. The iPhone had just got announced. Met with some VCs to kind of tell them about that. I wasn't even close to like being ready to start a company with it, but just a broad thesis around that. And one at Charles River Ventures, he's our arm, and he said, hey, like, why don't you kind of spend a couple months here and kind of figure out like what you want to do next, and you can kind of help with some of the stuff I'm looking at. He ended up doing a seed investment in a company called Blingo that was a MIT spin out. And I ended up joining those guys kind of in the early days, two visiting scientists from MIT that had figured out a new way to do voice recognition. So we built out that company for 4 years, amazing experience, got to do a bunch of different things, ran BD, ran marketing, consumer business, ran our financing, which was really interesting because I spent a lot of time on Sand Hill Road meeting VCs, who I'd now kind of starting to get to understand what they did. And just like honestly met a lot of like assholes, like a lot of people, just like terrible behavior. Like one guy, like a 4-course meal during the pitch. Others would talk on the phone, walk out of the room like mid sentence, and we'd be just sitting there with ourselves, like looking at each other, like, is he coming back? And so I think that had a big impact on me, because I started to think that this was something I wanted to do. But I also knew that, just being a normal, kind person gives you a big advantage in this industry. So we ended up selling that company. I moved back to New York where I'd lived earlier, became the chief business officer of another venture-backed business called Thumb that General Catalyst and SoftBank and a few others had invested in. We were acquired about a year later, so it's kind of a quick stint there, but again, learned a lot. And then during this time, kind of building these two companies, we're talking to with my now co-founders, ENIAC, about what we're going to all do next. They had started in growing their own companies. And I think one thing we knew is we weren't going to join a big VC firm and try and like work our way up. You know, it just didn't seem like for us. We wanted to start something new. So raised a really small fund, started investing in 2010. First fund was $1.5 million, which is like, it is a joke like today. And also it was pretty much a joke at the time. You know, amazingly, I'm still like, this always still shocks me. Like TechCrunch wrote an article about it. Like it seems, you know, like it must have been a slow news day to like write about such a small fund.
I mean, I'm in Chicago. So like, I still see $1 million funds launch with like the whole PR thing. And it's like, honestly, there are so many deals, and you know this from what you guys do and what you focus on, but there are so many companies running around that you can still put, like, I recommend more money than $1 million, but like you can still put a $50,000 check to work and see some pretty crazy returns with it. So like, yeah, I don't know. I wish we'd get away. Like, I wish as a tech community, we'd get away from this, like, oh, it's only $1 million. It's 10 mil. It's 100 mil. Oh, it's $1 billion. Like
it's 100%.
Yeah. The attitude is sad.
That attitude is wrong. And honestly, like, I think it's a luxury to have such a small fund. You know, you can get in a very highly competitive round. I see these like $400 or $500 million seed funds, and I'm just not sure how that works. But we'll get to that anyway.
We're definitely, just to earmark this for people listening, we are going to get to that because there's a topic towards the end of this conversation when we get into the nitty gritty of VC stuff where there's a case to be made, and you've kind of made it before on Twitter, and I'm sure others will make it, that the idea of being an LP in a giganto fund where you have absolutely no idea how to bring value, how to actually do anything, even what the investments are being made. There's an argument with the tools that are available today, whether it's AngelList, you're looking at crowdfunding or other things, that an individual could literally like self-invest and have their own fund or have a community fund with people. And it makes more sense depending on who you are. I get it if you're SoftBank. That's a different, you know, different league.
Sure.
But we will.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Yeah. So anyways, I got a little off track, but yeah, we've been building out ENIAC now for about 14 years, investing for 12 years. We focus on seed, you know, leading or co-leading seed rounds. We all have technical backgrounds, so we tend to like things with some kind of technical bend. We don't invest in like direct-to-consumer sneaker companies and stuff like that, but, you know, mainly software. And we have 12 folks in the team headquartered in New York. Just been, you know, enjoying building this with my now, you know, lifelong friends and a great team.
So there's two things you said there that I want to circle in on. One, which maybe goes second, so I'll start with a different one here. You said that you came into the one company as a chief business officer, and I'm just thinking time-wise, this is before chief business officer is like a popular thing. I feel like I am a chief business officer now because I'm the guy who sort of, we'll see if this changes from like what you were in your role as chief business officer. I'm sort of the loudmouth co-founder that has the public kind of following and is the connector and partnerships and recruiting a lot of it and raising capital, a lot of it. And generally speaking, like before a company gets large enough, unless it is directly B2B, we are a B2C and a B2B. So like before we get to the size where we have a whole division or a whole department of business partnerships, companies need to have someone who can connect and bring in other partners and other partnerships to the business. Eventually, essentially, I'm the brand spokesman, if you will. And I wonder, is that like, how did you look at chief business officer versus say, I know a lot of people who are chief business officer that do it like I do it, but the name doesn't really mean anything to a lot of people who are unfamiliar.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird title. I think
like entrepreneur in residence.
It was one of like three titles I think I had. And it's funny because I do meet a bunch of folks who are kind of in a similar case as I, and they want my advice on this. There's a scenario I think works well. I don't know if this is similar to your experience, where Dan, the CEO, was very product focused and really wanted, and this is a consumer product, really kind of wanted to spend the mass majority of his time on very kind of, you know, the details of the product and wanted to kind of open up the other and not have to deal with the other parts of the business, even though he had a very good business acumen. So I kind of drove everything else, right? BD, marketing, growth, partnerships, fundraising. So it was kind of like a jack of all trades. We were about a 12 person team. So I was the business team, I'm making air quotes for yeah. those not watching the video, you know, it was like I and one or two others, you know, so it's very early days, but that was a role that worked for me. I had kind of done all that stuff at Blingo. So I was kind of in a relatively unique point of view or situation to kind of have experience at all those areas and be wanting to be kind of involved at the early stages of a company.
It makes a ton of sense. It definitely resonates with me. And I'm going to guess a bunch of founders that are on here. I mean, for me, the company I'm talking about is Songfinch. I am a co-founder of Songfinch. It's not the first company that I've started. I've had a lot of different experiences. My co-founder, all three of my co-founders in this company have very unique areas that they bring to the business. John, who's a CEO, is an incredible manager of people. And to me, if he could spend more time making sure that the team is right, and that the process is right, and that we're, you know, dashboards, and we have a lot of visibility, and the company's growing quickly, that's most important to the business. And having somebody out there who's maybe, look at like a military analogy, you've got a sniper, like you're out 8 miles out and you're like, look, there's a tailwind coming. Like, look, this is coming next. My job is to kind of run out ahead and make sure that the contacts, the people, the money, the team, anything you need as a resource is going to be available when we get there. And I feel like I've met a handful of chief business officers, I'm also using air quotes, who I think have had a lot of experience. Maybe they've decided that being the people manager of the entire business isn't their like MO, or maybe it is and the other stuff isn't. But it sort of falls in between that like chief operating officer and CEO, kind of like I go department by department to make it right. And then I hand it off to someone who's better and more patient than I am.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think COO is a lot of startups would have made me a CEO. But the reality is I was much more outward focused versus right. You see a lot of COOs being more like your co-founder who's focused on managing the people.
Right, right. The second part of this, which will be our segue as we talk a little bit more into the VC side of this, is you had a tweet the other day, actually, or maybe it was today even, I think this morning, about the viewpoint of venture capital investors viewing the CEO as working for them versus the other way around. And I think that is something I couldn't believe. I believe in that so wholeheartedly, and it's not because now I'm on this side, but I've done investing and I've done this, and I just have always felt like one thing that was forgotten because it never needed to be said in the early days, the Zuckerberg days, the benchmark Uber days, like they had all the money and I'm just trying to get it. So like you make a lot of concessions, but the thing that got forgotten that I think I'm starting to see turn, and you're definitely one of the people who's kind of leading that charge, is you have raised a shit ton of money from individuals and you have between 6 and 10 years to deploy that money or you give it back. And I just look at it like you need something to put money in. You need good companies that are going to produce a certain amount of return. So you need me sometimes as much or more than I need you. And now with everybody having the ability to invest capital one way or another, whether it's a credit or not, like the need to put up with bullshit from people becomes less. And I think that there's those that have enough power and money that they continue to act a certain way. And you talked a lot about the disrespectful nature of that. But there's also some that are, I think, probably not going to have a long career going forward who have decided to take that approach and like double down on it. And it's nice to start seeing folks like you and others that I've had on the show who have like taken a very forward public approach about it. Like, I'm here to help for real. I'm not like, obviously I want you to be a good steward of my money. Like that goes without saying, but I'm not going to sit here and make like outlandish demands of you and have you come sit to a 4-course meal. Cause I want to.
Yeah. It's, you know, things have changed a lot. I think for the better, you know, when I first pitched VCs, there still was a pretty strong kind of power dynamic, like you're describing, in the VC's favor. You know, these days there's so much competition as an investor that, you know, I think you need to be kind of thinking founder first, and you need to kind of show that you can be really additive outside of the money. Strangely, I feel like a lot of VCs still haven't gotten the message. I mean, certainly not all. It's weird because I guess as a VC, you get pitched quite a bit and you have people reaching out wanting to talk to you. So I think that gives a lot of people a real kind of overinflated self-image and ego, which I don't think it's really warranted. You know, just because you got a job as a VC or even you raise money as, you know, for your own firm, that, you know, there's not anything that special. So I think things are changing for the better, but it is kind of amazing to me how many VCs still kind of live in this fantasy world that they're somehow, you know, this great thing just because, you know, people want to get money out of them. So I don't know.
I couldn't agree more with you. And I have to say, the humbling experience as a person who, excuse me, you know, prior to being in a position to invest any capital, you know, Technori had the stage events and we had thousands of companies and people come through over the podcast and whatever, over, you know, almost a decade. Then you go look at like any of your friends, whether they're very high powered VCs or they're just sole investors, and they've got the same pitch decks that I have. So I'm like flexing over here, like, yo, you got to come over with me, 'cause I got them all. And they're like, no, I got them all too. Like,
and you know, the weird thing is some of like the most successful VCs that kind of have mentored us and we've gotten to know over the years, they're much more successful than I, they've been doing it a while, are some of the most, you know, nicest, most genuine people. And you get some VCs that actually haven't been successful at all and they're complete dicks. So it just doesn't make sense at all.
I feel like it's the majority actually that have not been successful and are still dicks. And you know, the other part about the raising money thing, I think it's changing. There's always, in my mind, I'm certainly not saying we should be wearing suits and ties here. It's just money at the end of the day. But like, I think we're changing in the sense that there's a little bit more transparency and visibility around it. Like, I feel like if you're in VC, particularly if you're new to it, if you don't think it's any different than every other sales job you and your friends got out of college, like smile and dial and make promises and hope to like deliver on them, like it's not. Like, there's this idea that like, you join as a VC and the fund just hands you a book of money, which maybe in some cases, you know, happens, but I don't think that's probably very common. You are literally just out there like I am trying to push shit. You just have shinier shoes on.
100%. It's sales and then it's service, you know, right. Like we really are in the service business. So it's, you know, find a company you want to invest in, sell the shit out of them, you know,
it's money as a service.
Yeah. And then, you know, from there on out, as I say, like your job is to make them successful.
Well, speaking of success though, you guys have been at this now, you know, you said more than a decade. So clearly it's not working. I'd love to know, you know, some of the success stories, some of the things you guys have sort of learned over the decade of like, this is our kind of company. It doesn't have to be around the thesis or the capital or even the like founder unfair advantage BS. It's just like literally what we've learned is that at our check size and this, like, this is where we are successful. These are the ones that have turned into unicorns. How do you view that beyond just the investor so-and-so?
Yeah. I mean, part of it, I think, comes from kind of how we see ourselves being different. And, you know, at least in our own minds, is that, you know, we see ENIAC as a startup and we see ourselves, again, like, you know, we didn't come out and just raise $100 million. Like you see a lot of new funds these days. You know, we didn't come out having, you know, spun off, you know, all been investors at Sequoia and Andreessen and whatnot, and then raise 100. So we've always kind of seen ourselves as being underdogs and building our own startup. And I think that's kind of, that permeates a lot of how we work and how we work with founders and the founders we tend to look at. You know, at the end of the day, having kind of now been doing this for 12 years, the one thing that it always comes down to that I don't hear people talk about as much as I think they should is just the fit between the founders and the problem. You know, like people talk about being founder first as if it's like some, like it's just a great founder and like a less great founder. It's not how it works. It's how great are they to solve this problem? And like, do you really believe that they are the best people in the world to solve the problem? And that sounds kind of crazy. Like how, you know, how could they possibly kind of be out of, you know, 7 billion or whatever, how many people, but you building a startup is extremely difficult. You have to believe that they will win whatever market they're in. So you need to believe that they are the very best people. And of course, most people aren't going after that problem. So they don't need to be like the smartest person in the world per se, but they need to be that. And you know, it's kind of that, founder market fit is kind of what I think it tends to come down to. And then there's always a bunch of other shit you try and figure out and competition and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, that's like the biggest factor. And I found that the best decisions that we've made over the years are when we really kind of focus on that. And some of the worst decisions we made over the years is we get caught up in other things, especially at the seed stage. So I think that's probably been kind of the most like thing that's kind of permeates kind of everything we do when we look at companies.
I love to hear that. I think it's one of those things that, you know, talking about sales again here, good marketing, good branding has a good tagline. And usually the best tagline is super broad and almost indefensible. And it's just sort of assumed that like you wouldn't have said it unless you meant it. And the number of pre-seed and seed stage funds that I'm aware of who lead with this, like people first, founder first, bring value, add value, like same bullshit line. You can't ask a question about like, can you tell me more? Cause there isn't really an answer to it. And I think you summed it up so well. You know, again, I'm just using Songfinch because I'm sitting in the office here. Like you could look at our co-founders and say like, are some of these people distracted? They've had other things, like they've had successes and failures, not a college degree, they, you know, whatever number of factors. And the question really should have been like, tell me the problem you're solving, like just ballparks and like, help me understand why you're the one to solve it. And I'll be honest with you. We've talked to everything all the way through early Series A conversations with some of the biggest firms you just mentioned, never was asked. There's been a handful of like, and half of these people say people first, by the way, this is all founder first, whatever. I have at least $500,000 in our Series Seed came from people who never asked to meet the CEO, John, never even asked. Like wow. That blows my mind. And like, I feel like I'm trusted in a good representation. And I'm, you know, involved.
You just
in every
blew
single,
their socks off. And
yeah. I guess I gave a good, you know, there's association. We had good investors. There's always the tag along stuff. Sure. But even then, like I wouldn't give $100 to somebody without being like, can I at least meet the person who's going to get the check? Like, can I hear it from them? Like, you know, it just is incredible. We took the money though. I'm not going to lie. Their reputations preceded them. I'm fine with it, but it's just, we're entering a world and this is the evolution of this conversation as well. We're entering a world where things are more opened up. Everything was kind of like, if you'd asked me in 2016, other than what I knew from a handful of VCs that I personally was friends with, if you'd asked me what they do every day, I couldn't have told you what they were doing to make decisions, any of that stuff. Now with Twitter, which is our move to the next piece here, Twitter is opening the door to where so many people are conversating around their experiences, both founder and investor. Like investors, rightfully so, making comments about founders being completely ill-prepared, misrepresenting everything from the business, from the hires, every other thing. My favorite thing to have been shot down in the last year and a half has been the air quotes for everyone here, the advisors, my fucking favorite. The like name every fancy person on LinkedIn who's connected to me, but there's absolutely no association with the business whatsoever. Like these things are starting to come out. The founders are starting to make lists and publicly post them of investors that kind of blew them off or were disrespectful or dismissive. What do you think is the impact that you've seen? Like, I'd love to know just in general, like when you got on Twitter and how you started to develop your Twitter profile and really grow, and was it accidental or on purpose or whatever? We can get to that. But like, what have you seen as an impact of, and there's other social media, of course, but Twitter, I think Twitter VC and FinTwit is probably the only reason I'm there.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I think it's great. There's just a lot more information out there. You know, I mean, when I was building Flingo and Thumb, I had very little information of like what VCs were doing, even though I was kind of entrenched in the ecosystem, like you're saying. My path with Twitter, and I definitely spent too much time on it now, it's been interesting. I started using it very early. We were an early partner at Flingo of Twitter, where you could use your voice to send a tweet, and did that with Jack Dorsey. And it was like one of the very first consumers of their API. And then, but I wasn't a big, you know, back then it was weird because like most tweets were like, I'm going to have a sandwich. You know, it was like, it wasn't really thought leadership. It was right, like what you're doing, you know?
I kind of miss those days, to be honest. I can't believe I'm saying that.
It was a simpler time. And then my partner Nahal got them to give me @Hadley because someone was sitting on that. So I'm very fortunate to just have my first name. But I wasn't very active until about a year ago, actually. I'd retweet stuff or when we had news, I'd send it out. But during COVID, I was just having a little bit like depressed, I guess, just having trouble connecting with folks, meeting new people, you know, kind of stuck working from home all the time. And I challenged myself, could I write a thoughtful tweet or like someone would find somewhat interesting, in especially founders, for a whole week? And I actually, honestly, that felt impossible to me at the time. And I always saw these other folks in the ecosystem tweeting left and right. And I was like, man, how do they come up with all that shit? So anyways, I was able to do it from Monday to to Friday. And then I just kind of kept going. And actually, I've done it ever since, been over a year. You know, other than vacations, I pretty much write at least one tweet. And it's kind of my daily habit, like over breakfast, I sit there and write it and kind of time it to go out a little bit later. So it's been awesome. I've met a ton of people. It's been really cool, especially as COVID has ended, where I went to TED last week. I met three or four people that I've only connected, like chatted over Twitter. We did an event for NFT NYC. I met like eight people that I've, you know, like I've DM'd with or just like their stuff, and it came up, and it's just super cool. Like you actually get to interact with people at scale. And as much as people make fun of Twitter, and I've certainly been one of those people most of the time, you know, I really appreciate kind of the kind of community I've met through it.
Resonates with me so much. COVID, same deal. Obviously, Technori, you know, was always physical, and we, you know, we did the podcast at a WGN show, and you could call in, so there was some interaction. But we hosted, you know, weekly meetup, you know, monthly events, whatever, in, you know, seven cities at one point. COVID happened. I completely lost touch. Like, I can send you emails, newsletter. I guess I know if you open it, but like, not really. I'm not going through 30,000 people to make sure they all check my inbox. But like, I lost connectivity. And I'm a person who's kind of an introvert anyway. So I was like, oh, this is fine. Like, I don't want to see anyone anyway, until it wasn't. And then it became like Twitter was the place for like, that was the mess hall. It was the place for us to like bullshit around and talk and make jokes. And now, honestly, I kind of hope Elon doesn't actually buy this thing, because I genuinely really like the product for what I use it for. I know it has a lot of warts, but like for what I use it for, and seems like you use it for, it's a tremendous tool. Similar to what you just said, like it blows my mind. I was just at an event in Chicago last week, and there was like three people who follow me on Twitter and came up like, "Hey man, I just want to say hi, meet you. Like, I like your stuff." Like, what? Like, you, yeah. My wife doesn't like my stuff. Like, this is impossible. Like, who are? What kind of a loser are you that you're following me? But it's fascinating. You meet people that you genuinely probably would have avoided. Like, not in all cases, but like you probably wouldn't. Like, I get a ton of inbound. I don't need this. You don't get a chance to see who they are. And Twitter, for all of the weird, like ambiguous stuff and people just sort of anonymous, they actually do kind of show you who they are more on Twitter than they do in real life, because they cannot help but liking something that, you know, is whatever their truth, if it will. So totally, I really appreciate it.
Yeah. And I'm also an introvert, so I'm never going to go to like an event and just go up and start making small talk to people. So it is, even for kind of as like an icebreaker to then meet people in the real world, it's really great for me, because I do like kind of in-person interactions. I just don't want to like kind of walk up to a group of four people and just
start floating in the corner. Jabbering. I'm the dude in the corner, like chowing down, you know, shrimp cocktails and slamming martinis. Exactly. That's me.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh man. So last thing I got for here is going back to kind of the investment thesis. And I think Twitter has a huge impact, as we talked about. It also has an impact on funds and how they're able to raise money and connect with people. As you can imagine, you connect with all these people through DMs, and many of them, if they could become an LP, if they fit the mold or whatever, a lot of conversations with founders and things. I feel like, I know from a Technori standpoint, we went from a very, very Chicago centric to like national. And it is probably the reason we got acquired recently, was just the fact that we had grown from just this one little area to everything. And I'm curious the impact on deal flow and on what you're looking at. Like, has it expanded just because you've got more activity and see more things than before? Maybe, maybe not. And then I got a final question for you after that.
I mean, in terms of deal flow, yeah, it's expanded a lot over the last couple of years. I mean, we doubled our team in the last year from 6 to 12. You know, seed funds generally pretty small, and we've always kind of had a very small, close-knit group, and we just felt like we needed more horsepower. And my partners and I, you know, none of us have kind of investing backgrounds. We're all engineers. So we kind of tried to hire people that were different from us. We're in New York, so we hired a bunch of people from private equity and hedge funds, investment banking, that had a lot of experience on that side. And that's been amazing. Every Tuesday we get together and we talk about 35 investments or so. And then that's like a small bit of what the individuals on the team are meeting the rest of the week. You only bring your kind of best couple opportunities. So it's crazy out there. It's exciting, but I thought that VC was supposed to be kind of a cushy job, like, you know, meeting this many founders and then trying to kind of figure out, you know, who we believe is going to do great, you know, in having the being blessed to meet so many, you know, incredible founders and having to kind of choose between them is really difficult. So yeah, it's, I feel, and I don't see any end to it now. You know, I think the cat's out of the bag in terms of the world has become so much more entrepreneurial and it's amazing. And I think it's going to drive, you know, global GDP. It just makes job for folks like us harder, but yet, you know, more great talent to choose from.
Totally agree. And you look at it like it used to be very regional. You'd see all the companies in Chicago raise in Chicago and vice versa. The LPs, most of them come in Chicago with the exception of, you know, Origin or what, a handful of funds. And, you know, you're in New York, so you're probably getting a little bit more deal flow anyway, but it's probably a little bit topside at the time towards East Coast. And I feel like now it's just literally global. And I think that's going to be a good thing for everybody at the end of the day. And I no longer look at being a Chicago founder as being, you know, I'm pigeonholed to here. Like I can go to, I can have calls in Austin, LA, Vegas, across the, you know, seaboard if 100%. I want to, which is pretty great.
Yeah. It's only the last couple of years. You know, I've spent a lot of time in the Bay Area, but never lived there. And I've always had this kind of, I didn't want to live in the Bay Area. Not my cup of tea. And I always had this kind of FOMO of not being kind of in the center of things. And it's only the last couple of years that I haven't felt that, whether it's New York or Chicago or Miami or outside the US for sure. You know, just incredible stuff going on. And no one really gives a shit anywhere anymore, like where you are based. You know, you can work with anyone, you know, as long as it's like somewhat similar time zone. Yeah, it's just awesome how much things have opened up.
It is absolutely that. And we talked about the positives of this. I do think, to your point, GDP grows. I think the opportunities grow. I think in a longer cycle, but I do think it's going to be a part of this. You look at entrepreneurs and creators and solo investors. I think you're going to see an impact on what regular people are making on a daily basis and how they're making their money and all this kind of stuff. But in the short term, we do have a war going on in Ukraine, and we've got, you know, Bitcoin fighting, and we've got the inflation, and we've got interest rates, and there's all this stuff. The market seems like every other day it's 5% up and 5% down. What, as a VC, are you thinking with regards to deploying capital? Because I think this is the question. I don't know why I waited until the end of this for it, but this is the question that I think I, as a person who's in the process of raising money, want to know. And I think it's a question that a lot of founders, if they're not paying attention to when and how they're raising money and how much, should be listening to.
So our belief has kind of been pretty consistent on this is we don't purposely kind of change our pace of deploying over time. You know, at the end of the day, I think timing the markets is very difficult. I think predicting the macroeconomic situation is very difficult. If I could do that really well, I'd run a hedge fund and make a lot more money than you could as a VC. So, you know, we've been pretty much consistent. You know, we've invested in about 12 to 15 companies across the firm per year. We don't kind of set that number. You know, we try and kind of look for the best opportunities, but it's year after year, it kind of comes out right around that number, which for us is pretty concentrated across four GPs. And then we have a bunch of other folks on the team. So, you know, you're kind of talking kind of three to four, sometimes even less per year that we're leading or co-leading. So that's been our approach. I don't know what's going to happen. I tend to be an optimist, so I might be too much on this. I think we're going to have kind of, I would not try and, you shouldn't go by my predictions, but I think we're going to have kind of a choppy quarter or two. And then, you know, I'm a believer in kind of the long-term viability of tech. And I think that it's been kind of underserved to a certain degree for a while. And you have all these incredible people kind of focusing, and like the addressable market of venture is just so much bigger than it's been in the past, that I think we'll start having kind of growth again. And I think kind of the venture market will continue to grow kind of after maybe a quarter or two where everyone's a little scared because of what's going on in the public markets. But again, I'm not running a hedge fund, so don't take right. my advice on the future.
You know, like as a founder, I mean, this is just for anyone listening. This is how I'm looking at it. And I'm curious what you think, if you think I'm out of my mind. I look at this like for a lot of the funds, they've already raised the money that they've raised. They have to deploy it over a certain period of time. So like if any changes were going to happen, you know, do I think they might slow down for a quarter or two? They, you know, maybe they won't write as crazy a checks or something, but I think it's like a hint almost is like when we had early COVID and everything just kind of like, oh, we hit the like freeze button. The founders that are building profitable businesses, and I don't mean that they're profitable today, but like you can see the unit economics lead to profitability. Those stronger founders and startups with tremendous growth, continue to be tremendous growth, that don't piss their money away and run on good fundamentals, I think will raise even more money at better valuations than maybe they even would before. And those that have kind of been like pitch deck heroes, I think might find themselves in a bit of a jam. They may probably still raise the money, but probably not on the crazy $100 million seed round. I think there'll be a larger eye on them. If they raised money at a crazy valuation 6 months ago and they need more money, and you saw this with Fast, like I think you might be shit out of luck is what I think.
No, I agree with that. Because of the public markets having come down, the later stage stuff, the pricing's come down. So there's going to be some companies that are unfortunately just not going to be able to grow into those valuations. And then you have, I think, a lot of later stage investors that are kind of trying to figure out what pricing is going to look like. So they're just kind of taking a wait and see approach. I do think, again, like things will reprice, the market will reprice. And then, you know, and I think by kind of the end of the summer, we'll get back to some new norm. I'm not exactly sure what that looks like. And to your point, great companies are always going to be able to raise money, and they're going to raise money at higher valuations. You know, the whole venture capital machine is built to go after the big winner. So if you look like that, you're going to have no problem.
If only we could all look like that.
Exactly.
I speak the game exactly perfect. Like I said, they don't even want to talk to the CEO, but the reality is I do have to show you my charts at some point. This has been fantastic. I really appreciate you taking the time. You mentioned before, where do people go to follow you or learn more about the fund?
Yeah, follow me at Twitter at Hadley, and then ENIAC.VC. Love to connect. And thank you so much, Scott, for having me on the show. This has been incredible.
If you're interested in self-directed investing from startups to crypto and public markets, my Substack is a great way to learn how professional investors screen, review, and pull the trigger on deals. Join the largest community of micro investors and startup founders on Substack by going to Katoon.com.